This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than their worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members of FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
Check the backseat. Check the backseat.
All right, come here.
Check the backseat.
Gets in your head, right? Good. Because every year, dozens of children are forgotten in the backseat of a car by a parent or caregiver. All never thought it could happen to them. But with changes in routines, distractions, or a sleeping child, it can happen to anyone. Parked cars get hot, fast, and can be deadly. So get it in your head.
Check the backseat.
A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
Welcome to Strictly Business, Variety's weekly podcast featuring conversations with industry leaders about the business of media and entertainment. I'm Cynthia Littleton, co-editor-in-chief of Variety. This episode is a departure from our usual format of diving into industry issues. I'm extremely late to the party, but in the past year or so, I've been trying to come to an understanding of cryptocurrencies. It's not easy, and I'm not too proud to say that I still don't understand how you create intrinsic value by having computers crunch through very difficult math problems. But let's set that aside. As I learned more about blockchain, it occurred to me that technology built around transparency might one day be the antidote to Hollywood accounting problems. Hollywood dealmaking has historically been built around properties that kick off royalties and profit participation payments for decades to come in success. Could blockchain and its decentralized approach to banking be useful for situations like movies, TV shows, music, and Broadway shows where a number of participants might have small stake in the profits of a property over time? To answer these questions and more, I look for experts who bring different opinions to the microphone. We start with Tarun Chitra, founder and CEO of research and investment advisory firm Gauntlet. Chitra is also the co-host of the podcast The Chopping Block, which is my favorite podcast for trying to decipher what's happening in this digital arena. After Chitra, we get a much different perspective on DeFi, or the decentralized finance boom, from Lee Reiners, a professor at Duke University who studies financial regulation. Reiners has become a leading voice of skeptics who question whether there are genuine use cases for crypto beyond some of the nefarious things that it's become associated with, like ransomware attack. All of this heady stuff is coming right up after this break.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Snakes, zombies, sharks, heights, speaking in public. The list of fears is endless. But while you're clutching your blanket in the dark, wondering if that sound in the hall was actually a footstep, the real danger is in your hand, when you're behind the wheel. And while you might think a great white shark is scary, what's really terrifying and even deadly is distracted driving. Eyes forward, don't drive distracted.
brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Hey, it's Zuko and Kayla from The Wake Up Call. Enjoy your podcast, but when you're done, don't forget about us. We have a radio show. We try to bring a smile to your face every morning.
We also talk to some of the hottest country stars of today, and we like to share some good news with That's What I Like.
Because Lord knows that's hard to find. When you're done podcasting your podcast, listen to us at 92.3 WCOL.
Set your preset on your radio right now, and don't forget you can listen to us online on the iHeartRadio app.
And we're back with Conversations on Crypto, starting with Tarun Chitra, founder and CEO of research and advisory firm Gauntlet. Tarun Chitra, founder and CEO of Gauntlet, and a research and investment advisory firm that works in the crypto space. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I came across Tarun and his work in my interest, my sort of burgeoning interest in just trying to understand what was going on with crypto. What did all this stuff mean? I did not, like so many of it, I had no idea. I had no idea what people were talking about. I barely, you know, could define what crypto was, and went down the rabbit hole of reading and podcasts, many, many podcasts. And the one that I just fell for from pretty much from first listen is called The Chopping Block. And it's four guys. Tarun is one of them. And they're very active in crypto. They're investors. They're in the space. They're clearly in the trenches, and they're smart and they're funny. Some of the fun is listening. It's almost a puzzle. I listen and I'm trying to, you know, I hear the terms and then I try to back out and fit and figure it out. But I really enjoy. But what in all seriousness, you four do really well is tackle big, big concepts, and you use plain language, and you in the way that four friends talking to each other can kind of really get to the heart of something. You explain really complicated things in very plain language. And you also, I really feel like you pull no punches in terms of whether it's people in the crypto world, and there's no shortage of drama and headlines and litigation around a lot of those folks. But what are the benefits of the DeFi, the decentralized finance offered by crypto and blockchain technologies to markets like the Hollywood content business, which does have its own unique sort of characteristics of how profits are made and how they're dispensed over a long period? But let's just start with the sense of like the appeal of DeFi.
One framing that I like to have around DeFi is anytime you use a fintech app, say you use Venmo or use PayPal or Zelle or something like that, right? You're generally using things that are not real dollars. They're actually synthetic claims on real dollars. So you only get those real dollars when you say, hey, I'm withdrawing to my bank account, right? But yet you generally treat those synthetic claims to dollars as effectively a dollar, right? So if I have $20 in my Venmo account, I send you $10. We both technically have two claims. You know, there's an IOU from Venmo that owes me 10 and an IOU that owes you 10. Mm-hmm. Whereas it started with an IOU that only owed me 20. And so this idea that people have gotten so comfortable with not holding real cash and holding these kind of synthetic claims, everything from credit cards to Apple Pay, it's sort of been a thing that's sort of, I would say, from the 1980s onwards, been a big change in how people deal with money. On the other hand, it's actually one thing that is kind of crazy is that you can't really program things you do with that money. You can't really do risk-seeking transactions with that type of money. So, for instance, I can't use Venmo to pull together money from multiple people to like buy real estate or to invest in a company. I would have to go through the normal banking system, go through the normal legal system.
Right.
And one of the reasons for this is that it's very hard to guarantee in a lot of ways, the effective sort of property rights of a dollar in different environments. So that IOU that I have in Venmo is different than the IOU that I have at Zelle, which is different than the IOU I have when I go into my Robinhood account. And this idea that you have these different IOUs that are not interoperable is effectively one of the reasons it's very hard to do sort of risk-seeking transactions with those claims on dollars. In crypto, the number one product that has you know, usage is what's called a stable coin. Mm-hmm. Stable coins are these IOU style representations of dollars. So, you know, you have a wallet, you might have 100 stable coins in it, or you might have 1,000 stable coins in it. And the difference is those dollars can be used on any application of blockchain. It's as if, you know, you could just send money from Venmo to Zelle.
Right.
It's as if you and I could both create a new Venmo account called real estate purchase account, and we both send money to it, and then we both can invest with it, but we both have to sign. We both have to sign a transaction that says, hey, we approve this transaction.
And we both have rights to do this.
And we both have rights, and we have some way of codifying the contractual obligations and liabilities of those pooled assets.
Right.
So fundamentally, DeFi exists to service stablecoins and also native kind of crypto finance. But I think the part that, you know, I think excited people and also led to it growing dramatically is effectively the idea that people could do these kind of risk-seeking transactions with dollars and have use them in many apps. There's no kind of restriction on them. For people outside of the US who want to have dollars or want to have access to dollarized banking systems, this became a really big thing, especially in 2021 and today in places like Turkey and Argentina. The main thing about DeFi is that when you have this notion of permissionlessness, where, you know, anyone can build a smart contract that allows you to pool together assets to facilitate a trade or to lend out those dollars to someone else for a yield, those types of contracts, they have slightly different properties than normal finance. One thing that's sort of endemic or hidden in normal finance is that, you know, when there is a trusted third party, you can make a lot of particular assumptions about how users behave.
That's what you mean, like Wells Fargo, yeah. Citibank, a trusted third party being an old-fashioned financial institution,
or like a broker, like Robinhood or something. You know, like TD Ameritrade. I'm also including kind of like stock brokers and I'm lumping them all together for
an extension of big banking, right?
Yeah, is that there's a lot of constraints. So I'll give you just a sort of simple example that hopefully will illustrate why designing these smart contracts is a lot harder, and why the understanding the risk in these contracts is harder, and this, you know, sort of why my company exists. But one of the reasons I am going to do this is so that you can see that, you know, in order to make these kind of like permissionless dollars that anyone could build apps to that can immediately, you know, transfer balances and pool together assets and take risk on it, the benefits of it are high, but also the development cost is high relative to something that's using the existing banking system. So imagine that you're a seller of an item. I don't know, let's say you have a famous artwork and you're running an auction and it's an in-person auction. So, you know, we go to the town hall. I'm on the stand.
We have our paddles.
We have our paddles, and like, you know, the seller is doing the, you know, $1, $1, $2, $2, $3, you know, ascending price English auction. One assumption you make in that scenario is that the seller is also not a buyer, because, well, the seller is not, you know, they can't be in two places at once. They're not cloning themselves and also bidding in their auction.
Right.
But in the permissionless online world, that's very different. The seller could very easily make clones of themselves and be buyers in their own auction. Now, you might say, why would the seller want to do that? Exactly. They want to push up the price so that other people have to bid higher than what their true value is. And in a permissionless world, you have to assume that that's true by default, right? When you do an auction with a trusted third party, you usually assume, hey, they're not going to do X. And if there's any evidence, then I go sue them.
Right.
So you have to build
fees and right.
Well, there's still fees here. It's just more that they're not as adversarial, in the sense of you assume that if they did some malicious thing, you would be able to sue them or prove it in some way, and then use the legal system as a way of enforcing your rights.
Right.
But in the online world, that's not true. And so this has also been not true in even at large big tech companies. So, you know, in Google's online ad auctions, the DOJ, one of the strongest cases the DOJ has against Google is actually that Google purposely spoofed in their own auctions, like acted as a bidder to push up prices, exactly as I was describing. And so there is a sense in which when you design these systems such that I can have these digital IOU dollars move around everywhere, I need to design them with the assumption that because there's no trusted third party, people can be colluding arbitrarily. Mm-hmm. And someone who's selling me something might also be trying to, mm-hmm. to be manipulating the auction. Mm-hmm. And so this type of stuff is you need to actually build these systems such that the profitability of doing such things is actually low. Not just, hey, mm-hmm. I'm going to hope it works because I can sue them. Right. Those are two different standards. Right. One is actually much more, you know, you're trying to mathematically ensure they're right. not profitable.
And we all know lawsuits are a terrible way to enforce law. They're just, you know, right. wasteful and horrible, and only, you know, only the wrong people prosper, right?
Yeah, for sure. And so I think like there's a sense in which these crypto applications and DeFi in particular are built around building basic primitives that you would find in banking and finance, but in such a way that they're resistant to this type of collusion. And so mm-hmm. it's a lot harder to build those systems. They have to be resistant to much mm-hmm. different types of mm-hmm. adversaries. And they you know, if they break or they get hacked, then the money's sort of all gone. It's not mm-hmm. like it's not like a bank where there's a legal system. On the other hand, because of that, it's very easy once they do work for people around the world to use these things easily. And so the reason people are excited about it is like it basically unbundles a lot of banking services and makes it easy to use. You can kind of think of DeFi as sort of user-generated finance in the same way that a lot of social networks are sort of deal with user-generated content, like users making podcasts, users making videos. There's a sense in which finance has never really had users could never really generate products, right? It's not like traders who are trading on the stock market or the CME can like create a new financial instrument. But if you look at crypto, like if you look at meme coins, people are creating and destroying assets all the time.
Right. And people like me with meme coins and Dogecoin, I mean, all that, you know, these things that come out of thin air, it's as hard as I try. Like, how does this thing have value beyond a bunch of people snarking about it on X nowadays? But, you know, that's where there's just a leap there that, you know, but then I guess in that sense, it does become like a security or a collectible. You know, it's that Jimi Hendrix poster that is going to, you know, gain in value in age because some other huge fan is going to want it someday framed on their wall. Is that a reasonable way to think about it, or am I totally off?
Yeah. I think that's certainly one way of viewing it. I think like people, I think it's better to actually make a bit of a connection more to like traditional tech companies, so mm-hmm. Facebook and Google. Mm-hmm. From my perspective, they are derivatives exchanges, whether they want to say that they are or not. I mean, obviously, legally, it helps them to not be. But in some ways, they are creating and destroying derivative assets on demand. So let's say an advertiser says, hey, I want to target women in New York who are between 20 and 30 mm-hmm. who live in a particular neighborhood. Suppose no one goes onto Facebook who matches that criteria. Well, then the advertiser's dollars don't get spent. And you can almost think of it like an option. Like the advertiser bought the option for the right to sell the ad to that demographic. On the other hand, when those users go on the network, you could effectively think of Facebook as selling, like exercising the option on behalf of the advertiser and creating a new financial product, which is the ad impression that they made on demand to a particular set of users, and then they destroyed when those users are not present. And in that sense, you can almost view this idea that there exists mm-hmm. financial assets that are created and destroyed on demand in response to events and just in time as sort of something that is true, very true to like internet native assets versus not internet native assets. Mm-hmm. And I think this idea that we have things that can be kind of created on demand and then sold that are like sort of these sort of more complex financial assets, that is something that we all live with and breathe with every day on the internet, but we don't, it's not transparent to us. And I think in the crypto world, it's actually quite the opposite. It's like, it's very clear that that's what exists versus kind of, you know, what you see in normal stuff. So, you know, the reason I bring this up is, like, you know, you were mentioning this thing. It's like the Jimi Hendrix album that maybe I bought early. Well, the ad impression is the same thing. It's not actually clear it has any value, mm-hmm. but the advertiser is paying mm-hmm. a premium for the right to sell to that demographic if mm-hmm. they exist.
Right. And right? And going back to, you know, there, like, there's definitely precedent for the, you know, if you can bring me, there's very time sensitive advertisers, car advertisers, movie studio advertisers. I will pay you a lot of money for an advertising for an audience over these 2 weekends. And if you don't deliver, you owe me money. So there's real precedent for that kind of an agreement in a business transaction. That's interesting.
Yeah. And I think all that you're having with crypto is, like, people being able to do that in a sort of permissionless way. Like, I can create, you know, the difference in the Facebook case is Facebook controls the entire creation of these financial assets, right? An advertiser can request something, but, like, unless Facebook actually does the exercising of, like, delivering the ads to the user, then, like, it's never really happening. In crypto, the point is that the blockchain can do that execution for you without needing kind of the central party in the middle. Mm-hmm. And I sort of think that's one of these things where, yes, these things, it's like they might not have initial intrinsic value, but they're attention economy type of things where, like, there is a particular time and place where they might suddenly be valuable. Mm-hmm. In the mm-hmm. same way that the Jimi Hendrix album right. probably was peak value 20 years ago and maybe is flat or down a little bit now.
It has occurred to me that entertainment is a business where you have a lot for the creative community. You have a lot of people, you have a lot of properties that can generate significant revenue and profits, especially over time. You have a lot of profit participation deals. And sometimes you can have a number of people that have small stakes in something that will kick off meaningful revenue over a long period of, you know, 30, 40, 50 years, if you're lucky. And now, I mean, in the world of IP, it's, you know, just treasure trove time. So you have long tail, long payoff periods. And it occurred to me that, and then, of course, the history of Hollywood accounting, people fighting over, wait a minute, it made this much, but you took that much off the top, you padded it, all these fighting over Hollywood accounting. Wouldn't in the 21st century, in the modern era, wouldn't blockchain, something that is theoretically, not theoretically, but, you know, in something that is open, available to for all to see, can't be jimmied with, but actually can only be, you know, it's supposed to keep everybody honest, and all the transactions are supposed to be fairly recorded and, you know, there for all to see. So wouldn't that in a way be a good way to handle something like that? Or am I just completely off? Does that make any sense?
Yeah. So, I mean, this gets back to this type of thing I was talking about before, which is, like, the current fintech application stack, like the Venmo, Zelle, Revolut, whatever. Mm-hmm. If we're really, 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 really squinting, they are lipstick on a pig. They are front ends that are built around the existing bank system, right? They make it a lot easier to use. They make the front ends more intuitive. They hide a lot of the fact that banks are running 1960s servers still in some cases, but they're lipstick on a pig. They don't control their own destiny in the sense that they can't do risk activities. They can't do the type of thing you're talking about where people are pooling together money and investing in an endeavor without a bank being involved and syndicating it. And this gets back to this idea that in DeFi, where I can program these kind of risk-seeking activities where people mm-hmm. can pool together assets and use them in certain ways,
right?
That sort of being able to do that without a bank, and I can write my own code that gives the covenants for the law and the contracts implied, that is this idea of being user-generated finance. Like, I actually, like, that's a better way of thinking of DeFi than mm-hmm. the name decentralized finance, which is you can create whatever you want and you can do these risk-seeking things and you don't need a bank to be the custody of your funds, mm-hmm. in custody of the funds. Mm-hmm. You can have this kind of smart contract manage these IOUs and it's transparent to people. Mm-hmm. And so I think the hardest part for using a lot of this stuff for non-internet native and non-digital, purely digital assets is you have what's called the Oracle problem. If someone needs to convey what is happening off-chain to the smart contract, right? Someone needs to say, hey, we produced this movie mm-hmm. and we got $500 of revenue. So here's the, you know, I make an IOU.
$25 for you and $25 for the director, $25 for the star, that kind of thing.
But in an adversarial environment, like the person who receives the $500 might report only $495 to the contract and keep an extra $5 for themselves. Mm-hmm. Right. So there's this, for offline things, you have to have some way of mm-hmm. you know, the blockchain and like computers in general have no way of verifying this offline thing actually took place. Right.
Right.
And in the normal world, we also don't have a way of verifying it. We have a way of suing people afterwards if we think that it happened. And
expense.
Then the courts are Like, and there's a sense in which that is oftentimes the biggest thing. Whereas for digital native assets, things online already, it's very easy for them to prove that they got cash flow in a certain way. So one type of thing that's very similar to this, that's sort of similar to what you're talking about, that I've seen some people start to try to do is lending, online lending to people who are creators. So people say who are like YouTube creators, who based on their statistics,
that makes sense.
Based on like you can anyone can go to YouTube and verify, you know, you're trusting Google, but like at some point, like, well, they're the ones hosting it, so there's no real incentive initially for them to lie. You can go look at how many followers someone has. You can go look at how many likes, and many people can submit that to a smart contract. And like, if everyone submits roughly the same answer, the contract can say, okay, this person has 10,000 followers and their videos get 100K views a day. And currently there's some price that Google is paying per view on average. And so we expect this creator will earn X income.
They actually have predictable cash flows.
And you can lend against that.
Hold on to your Bitcoin. We'll be right back after this short break.
Snakes, zombies, sharks, heights, speaking in public. The list of fears is endless. But while you're clutching your blanket in the dark, wondering if that sound in the hall was actually a footstep, the real danger is in your hand when you're behind the wheel. And while you might think a great white shark is scary, what's really terrifying and even deadly is distracted driving. Eyes forward, don't drive distracted. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
It's the Breakfast Club, the world's most dangerous morning show.
Hey!
Angela Yee is kind of like the big sister that always pokes you in the forehead.
That's not how it goes?
That's not how anything goes.
Yemi's really like a robot. One of the best DJs ever.
Believe that.
Charlamagne is the wild card.
And I'm about to give somebody the credit they deserve for being stupid.
I know, that's right.
What is wrong with you?
Listen to The Breakfast Club weekday mornings from 6 to 10 on 106.7 The Beat. Columbus's real hip-hop and R&B.
And we're back with new perspective on the crypto market from Duke University professor Lee Reiners.
Professor Lee Reiners of Duke University, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's great to be with you.
Tell me what sparked your interest in crypto and why have you been so willing to be out there and be a voice of skepticism as to the real world use case for this most cutting edge technology?
Yeah, I think, you know, my interest was sparked like so many folks' interest, which was just, you know, I was just curious, right? You know, I was beginning to hear and read about, you know, this new form of digital money that was independent of the government and the central bank, and it was peer-to-peer, and it was going to, you know, disrupt the banks and, you know, didn't rely on intermediaries. And so, you know, I just started to dive in and learn what I could. You know, at the time, I was actually working at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. You know, so I was an examiner of large financial institutions. And so I kind of, you know, shared some of the early crypto community's skepticism of the legacy financial system, right? And if you actually go back to, you know, the Bitcoin white paper, which is what launched this, you know, all this cryptocurrency stuff we're talking about today, you know, that was Halloween 2008. The first Bitcoin transaction occurred in January 2009, and that first transaction actually occurred a reference to a headline from the Times of London about bank bailouts in the UK. So, you know, from the kind of very beginning, I sort of thought that I was kind of ideologically aligned with this community, right? I mean, a bank examiner is not a job you go into if you think, you know, Wall Street is the greatest thing since sliced bread, right?
Right.
So that was kind of my initial foray. Then about 7 years ago, I came to Duke and I started teaching classes on, you know, financial regulation, regulatory policy. And so I just started to think about, you know, how does cryptocurrency fit or not fit within existing regulatory frameworks? And how should financial policymakers and regulators adjust? And so I was starting to write about crypto, you know, back in 2017, 2018. I mean, it's an eternity ago. And I like to joke, Cynthia, that crypto years are like dog years, right?
Right.
So it's been a long time. You know, I never would have thought that the industry would have gotten to this point in size and scale and notoriety and you name it. And, you know, the industry in the asset has defied predictions from the very beginning. So, you know, I can guarantee you whatever predictions I make today with you are probably going to be wrong. Just like most everyone's predictions about crypto have been wrong from the very beginning. But, you know, I started to get concerned, I guess, as time went by and some of the proposed benefits of crypto really didn't materialize. And we're starting to see the harms, right? Very real and tangible harms. And that really hit home for me, I would say, in 2021. And if folks remember the Colonial Pipeline hack, right? And, you know, that was a big deal. Obviously, it's a big deal nationwide, but especially here on the East Coast and the Southeast, because you were seeing, you know, gas shortages, right? I mean, you, you would drive by a gas station and it was closed. Or, you know, if they did have gas, it'd be like a long line. So, you know, these are scenes that, you know, most Americans haven't seen since, you know, the Arab oil embargo in the late 70s, right?
Since I was about 10 years old. So, yeah.
That's right. I'm not going to date anyone here, but
I will.
But you volunteered, Cynthia.
Yes.
So, you know, and the reality is that, you know, ransomware is fueled by cryptocurrency. Now, it's true that ransomware does predate crypto, but you weren't reading about it on the front page of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. And the fact is that every single ransomware attack, the attackers demand payment in cryptocurrency, right? And so I start, and you know, this actually hit home for me because my wife and I had been on vacation when the hack occurred. We came back and we couldn't get an Uber or a Lyft from the airport home because they couldn't get gas. So no one was driving. So we were essentially stranded at the airport. And then my brain just started churning. And then I just, you know, and at that point, obviously I'd been, you know, thinking about, you know, these issues and crypto for a few years. And I just kind of came to the realization that, you know, this is doing more harm to our society than good. And frankly, it's kind of hard to see what good has, you know, matriculated at this point, because, you know, again, going back to 2008, right? You know, this technology is not new, right? I mean, this is 16 years at this point. And technology tends to prove itself pretty quickly, right? So by way of comparison, the iPhone was 2007. I think anyone who sort of held an iPhone or a smartphone in their hand for the first time fundamentally understood that this was a transformative technology, right? But here we are 16 years later, and we still haven't seen crypto or blockchain's killer use case. So you just kind of have to ask yourself, if it hasn't happened yet, when will it happen? But in the meantime, we've seen all sorts of fraud that you've mentioned in your intro there. You know, we've seen the rise of ransomware attacks. We've seen crypto being used to fund terrorism and bypass U.S. sanctions, right? And so, and I could go on. I mean, there's more. There's, you know, scams involving, you know, pig butchering, right? You know, romance scams that that rely on crypto. So I think if you just took a step back from an objective perspective, it's pretty clear to me that the harms vastly outweigh the benefits. And then I think, you know, the challenge then is coming across back to the East Coast and DC is, well, what do you do about it from a regulatory standpoint, right? And, you know, we don't have the most functional Congress right now. That's putting it mildly. You know, we're heading into an election season now. Crypto's sort of not top priority for most politicians right now. So, you know, I think the status quo from a regulatory standpoint is going to prevail. And, you know, I think we're continue to see, you know, average folks get harmed by crypto just as they have been for the past, you know, 16 years.
What's the calculation that says that computers crunching those numbers down to infinitesimal degrees creates value?
Well, you know, values in the eye of the beholder, Cynthia, right?
Yeah.
You know, and you've touched on a few important things. I think one is just, you know, kind of Bitcoin mining, and maybe it's worth just explaining for folks kind of what's happening there, what's going on, because
including your host here.
that's right. You know, and I'm not going to disagree that it's wasteful. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, you have, as you mentioned, you know, millions of computers at this point in time. And when you think of, you know, a Bitcoin mining facility, just picture in your head, like, you know, an AWS server farm or a Google data center or something like that, right? I mean, that's what we're right. talking about at this
lots
point in time.
Lots of computing power.
Yeah, lots and lots of computing power. And it's evolved over time. Obviously, as Bitcoin has become more popular and the price has risen, you know, that has incentivized, you know, larger, more sophisticated players. I mean, in the early days, you know, you could run, you know, a mining node on your laptop, right? But those days are long gone. So, you know, by design, Bitcoin runs on the blockchain, right? That's the underlying technology,
right,
that underpins Bitcoin. And a blockchain is just a database, but it's a distributed database where everyone who runs that, you know, blockchain software has the exact same copy of the ledger. And they all agree on the contents of that ledger and the latest batch of transactions that should be added to that ledger, but they don't know one another. So how do you get all these people to agree on the canonical truth
mm-hmm.
when they don't know, nor do they have any reason to trust one another? And that's what mining is all about. Mining is just all about updating the ledger with the most recent batch or block of transactions. And so how does that happen? Well, it happens by essentially guessing or solving a very computationally intensive math problem. And if you're able to do that, and so to guess correctly just requires a tremendous amount of computing power, right? Which takes energy, okay? If you're able to do that, then that miner wins the right, in essence, to post the most recent batch of transactions to the blockchain. It broadcasts that to the entire network, and everyone agrees because everyone can see that this miner incurred the cost, right? That they solved this puzzle. So the puzzle is basically just a cost, okay, that's imposed on mine. Because if you didn't have a cost, then any bad actor could just hijack this network if they had enough computing power, right?
Right.
So you need to have a cost in order to incentivize, you know, ethical behavior. But of course, no one's going to do it if all there is a cost. So they need a reward as well. So there's a block reward. So if you're successful in solving this puzzle, then you get a certain amount of new Bitcoin. And actually that amount, that block reward, halves every couple of years. And in fact, we're approaching the next halving. And there's also things like transaction fees. So if I wanted to send you a Bitcoin, you know, I could add a transaction fee that would go to the miner in that transaction, that would sort of incentivize the miner to include, you know, my transaction in the most recent block. So that's what mining is really all about. It's about imposing a cost and then having a reward, right?
Right.
And there's different ways. There's less energy intensive ways. So the second most popular cryptocurrency, Ethereum, a few years ago switched from the very energy intensive proof of work mining process, which is what Bitcoin used, right? The work being you solve that puzzle to proof of stake, where in essence, you have to kind of risk a certain amount of Ether, which is the native cryptocurrency for Ethereum. And sort of the more you risk or the more you stake, the more likely you are to be able to update that blockchain. So that's the mining. But again, to your question, how does that translate into actual value? And this is, to me, a conundrum that has yet to be satisfactorily answered by anyone that's sort of pro crypto, right? Which is like, again, valuation. Okay. So what is it? I mean, stocks and bonds, traditional financial instruments, have sort of established valuation methodologies, right? You look at the current market price,
right?
And then you as an investor make a determination. Is it overvalued or undervalued? Now, again, there are models and methods that help you make that determination, notably discounted cash flow analysis, right? And not to get too wonky and financy here on an entertainment podcast, right? But, you know, companies generate cash flows, right? And they will generate them in the future. And then an investor can sort of discount that future stream of cash flows to a value today, right? Well, of course, with crypto, there's no cash flows, right? There's nothing to discount. Okay, so maybe we can think of crypto from a valuation standpoint as akin to other types of currencies, right? Like the dollar or the euro. How are they valued? Well, they're valued relative to one another, right? There's a dollar euro exchange rate, you know, a dollar yen exchange rate.
Right.
And those exchange rates are going to be based off a number of different, you know, factors like GDP growth in the two countries, inflation rates in the two countries, interest rates in the two countries. Again, concepts that do not apply in the cryptocurrency context. So where does that leave you? I mean, to me, it's an asset that from the beginning has traded entirely on sentiment, right? And you see this clearly when, you know, a few years ago, Elon Musk would, you know, send out a tweet about Dogecoin and right. the price of Dogecoin would jump, or he'd say something bad about Dogecoin or Bitcoin and the price would go down, right? It's an asset that trades entirely on sentiment and narrative. And that narrative has evolved over time. So for the longest time, the narrative was that Bitcoin in particular was digital gold, because per the code, Bitcoin source code, there's only going to be 21 million Bitcoins ever created, right? That can't change, right? That's in the code. And so there's a fixed supply, just like there's a fixed supply of gold. And just like gold is a hedge against inflation and, you know, the market, the
currency,
stock market.
Fluctuations.
You know,
yeah.
So too is Bitcoin, right? Well, that narrative was shattered back, you know, beginning in the fall of 2021, when inflation started to go up, right? And we've all lived through the horrible inflation over the past couple of years, and Bitcoin and crypto prices, you know, tanked. Okay. So it's obviously not an inflation hedge when inflation's going up and Bitcoin's going down. I just haven't seen anything with rigor that would suggest, you know, you can say, okay, crypto at, or Bitcoin at $50,000 is overvalued or undervalued. It's just entirely subjective and, you know, based on sentiment.
How liquid is it? Like if you, I mean, obviously in the throes of a crisis, anything, you know, any bank, any security is going to have problems, but just on a typical Tuesday, is it, you know, are you, and forgive, I'm betraying my ignorance here, but I appreciate you teaching me on the air here. On any given day, if you wanted to sell 10 or 100, is it a like, you know, if anybody wanted to sell 10 shares of Disney stock or 100 shares of Disney stock, you could do that in a split second online and be, you know, if you, depending on what time and where you bet, you would, you know what you were going to get, and you could, you could make the decision, am I going to hold it a couple more weeks, months, years, kind of thing. How do you do that with crypto?
It's not very liquid. You know, and of course, you know, just like stocks, you know, there are going to be some cryptocurrencies that are more liquid than others, right? So, you know, Bitcoin is going to be like the most liquid, but it's still not very liquid, right? I mean, and we've seen numerous instances where, you know, there's been a large trade that's moved the price, you know, one way or right. the other. And of course, it doesn't help in this context that, you know, the blockchain is sort of fully transparent, right? That you can, you know, everyone can see every single transaction that's ever occurred on the Bitcoin blockchain, you know, which means that people can kind of pick up quickly if there's selling pressure or on the, you know, or buying pressure. Although, you know, even with that has to be caveated because, you know, most trades in crypto are done via centralized exchanges, right? A la FTX. And those
The dearly departed,
right? Yeah, they finally decided that they weren't going to bring, you know, they weren't going to revive FTX 2.0. So it's now a liquidation. You know, so those trades, like, you know, so the average person, right, buying, selling, you know, Bitcoin, they're doing it through a centralized exchange, right? Obviously not FTX anymore. You know, but let's just say Coinbase, right? They're the biggest in the US. Well, when you trade via Coinbase, there's never actually a transaction that occurs on the blockchain, right? Instead, what's happening is that Coinbase has a database, just like every regulated financial institution has a database that tracks debits and credits, right? That, okay, you know, Lee has, you know, X Bitcoin, you know, Cynthia has, you know, Y amount of Bitcoin. Let's say I buy, you sell, and they're just going to reflect that on their own internal database, right? That's how the transaction occurs. Now, there should be, you know, Coinbase should have a blockchain address with sufficient amount of Bitcoin held at that address to cover all of the Bitcoin that their internal database, say, belongs to their customer, right?
Right.
But our transaction never actually occurs on the Bitcoin blockchain. And so, you know, so there's just limited liquidity at even, you know, an exchange like Coinbase. So if you wanted to get rid of a large position, it's going to be very hard to do that. One of the great ironies of crypto, and there are several, you know, but for a technology premised on, you know, disintermediation and peer-to-peer payments, when you look at the industry, it is littered with intermediaries, right?
Right.
That's, again, right. How most people access crypto is through centralized intermediaries. But these intermediaries, unlike banks and, you know, stock exchanges and, you know, retail brokerages, they're not regulated. Again, as many people have found out the hard way.
Well, I hope you found those perspectives enlightening. In truth, I think the answer to my fundamental question about blockchain in Hollywood is not yet, but it's always good to ask a lot of questions. Thank you for listening. Be sure to leave us a review at Apple Podcasts or Amazon Music. We love to hear from listeners. Please go to Variety.com and sign up for the free weekly Strictly Business newsletter. And don't forget to tune in next week for another episode of Strictly Business.
My name is Ariel. I moved to the U.S. at 19. I spoke no English and I struggled finding job opportunities. Everything I have, I owe to the Adult Literacy Center and getting my high school diploma at age 22.
It was an honor helping you achieve your greatness. Now you're helping others achieve theirs. It inspires me.
When you graduate, they graduate. Find free and supportive adult education centers near you at finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.